Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans. And I'm joined today by Dr. Serge Santos, founder and CEO of Funding Alternative Group. Welcome to the pod, Serge.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you for having me on.
Yeah, very excited to have a conversation today. So by way of introduction, Dr. Serge Santos is an entrepreneur, an investor, and an award-winning leader known as the business physicist. That's a fantastic title. We're going to dig into that. Serge began his career in investment banking and hedge funds, deploying over $1 billion in capital. Not many people can say that. Before founding Certus Capital in 2013 and achieving a multi-million dollar exit. Now, as founder and CEO of the Funding Alternative Group, Serge is tackling one of the most pressing challenges in the UK, SME access to finance. And this is something that we've lived as an agency as well. We got access to finance, which we'll talk about. And it was absolutely critical for our business. Since 2022, the platform has deployed $8 million in SME loans and $18 million in invoice finance, helping small and medium-sized businesses grow when traditional lenders fall short. He also leads other ventures under his holding company, Bedrock Enterprises. But today we're going to dive deep into how Serge and his team are transforming SME finance with Funding Alternative. Welcome to the pod, Serge.
That was quite an introduction.
We try.
I should probably stop there before I undo it, right?
Yeah, no, we try. Hopefully it was complete. But let's jump in. And one thing we'd like to do on the pod is just set the scene for our listeners of Tech Can't Save Us and kind of understand the landscape and the market that you're operating in. So, you know, tell us what was broken or what is broken in the SME lending market and how is Funding Alternative hoping to solve that, working to solve that?
Sure. So what is broken is the key question. So banking, as we know, works for corporates, but definitely not for small businesses. So since 2008, banks have pulled back. And very, very often, they want property as a security or a big balance sheet. But if you are a small seasonal business or run on credit card receipts or are a nascent business, you probably get declined very quickly. They are also very slow and very bureaucratic. It can take weeks to get a decision. And that's when, in reality, most SMEs need an answer in hours. So beyond that, there is also no client care. Banks don't stand with you when things go wrong. And this is a big problem for a lot of SMEs. On top of that, their products are very rigid. One size fits all doesn't work for SME. For instance, whole sectors like retail, hospitality, and construction get excluded very often. So the trust gap has widened, and a lot of SMEs don't feel understood. And this is exactly why we started Funding Alternative, to fill in this gap. So we, you know, our ethos is human first, and we have a mantra that is we are more than money. We see ourselves as partner and not just paper pushers. And we stand beside our clients when things go well, but when they don't as well, we're there for them. We try to be as flexible as we can. And we typically can approve in as little as 4 hours up to £2,150 of loan.
That's great.
And yeah.
Just diving.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just diving into that, how do you get around, I mean, the housing piece is really interesting. So how do you get around the, needing to have housing as collateral for a lot of these loans? Like what? How do you maneuver around that? I'm just curious about that specific piece.
Yes, we typically do what's called unsecured loans and lending. So we looked at a company based on its strengths and how it is trading. So all our underwriting and all what we do is based on cash flow and looking at the strengths of a business. We also look at a few elements, very important, how directors and owner of the business are thinking about their businesses and what they do with the businesses, their track record as well. We try to understand where they're coming from. Most of the cases we lend to have had tough times, and there are very good reasons why they are in need for capital. So we are definitely putting our thinking hat and think very hard about why is someone getting a loan at this point in time. Yeah. So we don't need the security. That's the short answer. Or security is the business and is the commitment of the director, typically. Mm.
Yeah, we'd love to dig into that because, I mean, we've had a personal experience with lending. We've got, you know, $400K from Creative Growth Finance, and, you know, we are grateful for that, and it changed our business. I think in retrospect, you know, we would have done things differently with the money. Let's just put it that way, right? So your point about kind of, you know, leaning in and supporting the directors, really understanding, you know, their financial literacy themselves, understanding what needs they have to take that money and actually grow with it. And obviously there's market conditions that are always a factor. But yeah, really curious to hear, how do you, you know, show up as more than just the money and really coach and support these leaders?
Yes. So I think behind that, there's this ethos. And so we're looking at it from a human perspective, but also there is an all element and DNA of discipline. So we're not lending to force collections. So we always, when there are problems with the companies and our clients, we start by finding solutions to keep our clients trading while protecting our capital. So we had very low loss rates, below 4%, which is pretty exceptional in our space, which is a very risky space from a lending perspective. And behind all of this, there is tech. So we use open banking that give us real-time data. So we can see how a business is performing today and not relying on stale accounting. So we have a system to monitor our client's life that helps flagging issues early on so we can step in. Go ahead.
I'd love to dig into this open banking question because I don't think our audience like fully knows everything about open banking, but walk us through how a technology like open banking can transform, you know, SME access to capital. And just if you can explain how open banking allows you to, you know, better assess risk and kind of tailor the funding that you offer to specific businesses.
Yeah, sure. So open banking has changed the game in, I would say, three big ways. First, the speed, because open banking can plug in directly into a client's bank account. Obviously, of course, with their permissions. So we can see live transactional data. That means we don't have to wait for management account or PDF statement to be issued. We can pre-approve funding in a matter of weeks, of hours, not weeks. And that's quite key. But we can also monitor what's happening at the business level on a day-to-day basis. The second point is fairness. Because before, traditional lender relied on financial statements. And if you had, say, two bad years 2 years ago, this would have still hurt you today. But open banking let us see how the business is performing right now. So if you're trending up, we can reflect that in the way we look at the company. And this is a very important playing field for SMEs. So we can improve and lend to business that would have otherwise been overlooked. And The third aspect is visibility and risk management. Because when you lend, obviously, you take huge risks. So it helps us tremendously to get much greater visibility on the performance of the companies. And that provides a real comfort when things are going well. But equally, when it allows us to react quickly when things move against a client.
Yeah, I'd be curious, like first of all, the open piece of open banking seems really critical. So how do you get SMEs to agree to that level of transparency? And I guess as a funder, you know, how do you tailor how you react to that? Because you can obviously see things in real time. So I can imagine the instinct maybe sometimes is like, oh, we got to jump in and support, but you don't always necessarily want to do that and let people run their businesses. So just curious if you have any examples of how you've sort of navigated that balance.
Yeah, I mean, the balancing act is one of the key aspects of this is you want to make sure that you are in touch with or you speak with your clients on a regular basis. And open banking will help us to understand when do we need to be more proactive with them to try to understand if they have issues with their suppliers or with their payments cash flows. And then very early on, discuss with them either maybe a payment plan, or maybe to give them some time to rebuild a bit of treasury without having necessarily to push for a higher repayment. So it helps us to create transparency, and that's a precondition for us to lend. We wouldn't allow we wouldn't lend to a business who wouldn't agree to open banking. And you know, some businesses will have probably some issue with that, are probably the one who are probably less, being less transparent means you have something to hide. As simple as that.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's good to hear about the transparency and kind of, hey, you know, I think there have been moments in our funding journey where we've really wanted and needed, you know, a bit more help, a bit more, you know, strategic input. I think that we've had a mix of, you know, accountants and you know, I'm a growing, you know, CEO who doesn't come from a finance background. So, you know, I think there are moments when how we wish that support would have been pushed in. But also there are moments where, you know, you want to be left alone to manage a business. And sometimes you can only learn by experience. So that balance is so tricky to navigate, especially mm-hmm. when big money's at stake.
Agreed. No, it's not easy for any business. And yeah. you can, you know, there are a lot of external factors you don't control as a company. So you are exposed to a lot of surprises, starting with the suppliers asking to, or not supplying the goods, but having been paid or wanted to be paid before you even supply the goods, to customers refusing to pay when their invoices are due. So, or payroll coming at the wrong time, or corporate taxes being payable, or VAT when you don't want this to happen because you have a very low working capital.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the finance journey has been, you know, the biggest journey for me, I would say, because I just don't come from that background. I started my career in education and nonprofits and things like that. So it's been a real journey to like learn to respect and appreciate what you do, you know, to be really honest. And seeing, we had, you know, in the recent past, you know, we need some emergency financing and we got it, luckily. I wish we had heard about funding alternative before we did that, but and you really start to realize, like, look, this is about keeping the lights on. This is about paying payroll. This is about making sure that clients get the services that you've committed to. And just because your cash is, you know, maybe not where you want it to be, it shouldn't stop you from doing those things. And there should be a way to bring in that funding and to, you know, not have it cost an arm and a leg and allow you to continue your mission as a company. And so just like seeing that and appreciating that, the role of, you know, funding and finance in the sector, I think has been really humbling for me and really enlightening. So just to give you some kudos at what you do, I think is really important to the mission of so many organizations.
Thank you.
We'd love to jump into growth, and obviously we're a growth strategy, you know, company, and we've kind of grown into that as that growth partner role from being an agency that just did content and SEO. We'd love to talk to you about your biggest growth challenges, but also opportunities for funding alternative. Like, where do you see your biggest hurdles? Is it acquisition? Is it regulation? Are there big competitors out there? Just walk us through your sort of overall picture for growth.
Sure. For a start, for us, the biggest hurdle is not really customer acquisition. We have typically between 250 or 300 inquiries per month, and we only lend to 10 or 20 clients every month. So that's not the key issue. Regulation is also very manageable in our space because a regulator doesn't view this market as particularly risky. So it's not a heavy burden on us. But the real challenge for us is access to funding. We've just started raising institutional capital. Until now, the business has been funded entirely by me as a founder. We never relied on third-party capital. And that's quite unusual in our space. But the issue is that a lot of our competitors and predecessors have been quite reckless in the past. So they took huge risks, often with money that wasn't really theirs. So that left a challenging reputation for lenders like us to overcome. But from day one, we've been very deliberate about building a scalable business model and differentiating ourselves. So we build discipline into our DNA, and that has helped tremendously.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's a perfect segue into my next question, which was about, you know, partnerships and collaboration. It sounds like you're beginning to structure those partnerships with institutional funders. Talk us through, what have those conversations been like? You know, how are you feeling about, you know, finally taking money from institutional funders, and how has that changed your business and your growth strategy, if at all?
It will absolutely change the way we scale and also the way we think about the future, because that will give us more room for adding products and have more flexibility. Having said that, it comes attached with obligations. When you take institutional capital, they will put limitation on what you can do, which could be a problem. So we have to select our partners very, very carefully. And since our business model is high risks, we tend to lend to companies that wouldn't find a home elsewhere. We have to make sure we don't restrict ourselves going forward. And this is to balance with the fact that we use tech to help us, but also with the fact that the human is at the core of our decision making. So scalability is also a question of discipline, having procedures and policies, and try to still keep flexibility. So these are the challenges we're facing. But our discussion with lenders or institutional money has been, curiously enough, on about size. We are starting now, we're looking between 5 and 10 million. And for this type of businesses, it's very small. They would want to give us 20 or 30 million, but you know, we don't want this money. We want to make sure we grow very sensibly. And that's the biggest challenge we have. We are in the sweet spot of being too small for institutional, but we don't want to grow too fast because we want to stick to our values and DNA.
And so are you thinking of shifting at all, or how are those conversations going, convincing institutional funders to, you know, to look at smaller funding rounds?
We are looking into a round of 5 to 10 million with some compromises on, I'm really sorry for that. Some compromises on, extending, basically expanding the set of product we can offer, so that will allow us to deploy more capital. Because the biggest issue is having capital costs. It's attached with cost of capital, so you don't want to be forced into a corner where you don't want to be. You don't want to be forced to relentlessly if you don't find the right opportunities. And so the discussion is basically to find the right partners. We have been talking to 5 or 6 very serious lenders, and I'm sure we will find one because they like what we do. But it's like a partnership. It's like a dance. We need time to get to know each other, and it will take time.
Yeah. You've got some great, I love scalability is about discipline. That's a great phrase. And, just the idea that it's a dance. And we felt that as someone who's received funding, as like this tension and this push and pull with your funder for performance and, you know, how you organize your business, things like that. So I think that's really well said. Yeah. Jumping back in, like one thing you mentioned is like the biggest issue is the cost of capital. I assume that's both sides of the equation. Like, do you mean the cost of capital for you to sort of, you know, get institutional funders and funders in the door so that you can lend, and also for the funding recipient?
Typically, it's first and foremost for us, because we need to ensure that our business model is sustainable. Yeah. So that's a start. So if you have a lot of cash on your bank account, that comes attached with risk, and this is not productive. So you're paying someone, and this can be quite draining for a lender. So we have to be extremely cautious with that. The other part of the equation is the market. So we tend to lend to businesses that are risky, so we charge accordingly, in that sense that we want to just cater and make sure we get enough provision for default. And we have default, we have adverse situation we have to and to collect upon, but collecting takes a lot of time. There is a lot of capital that can be lost. So the market will dictate how much customers are or clients are willing to accept as loan charge for their loans. And the same applies for our competitors. So there is a moving market on that front, but there's also the fact that if you have capital, they are typically fixed term for 3-5 years. So you pretty much stuck in between a rock and a hard place as a lender if you take too much cash in one go. And that's the biggest risk for lenders. And a lot of lenders go bust because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about the lender side of it, because I think we feel it as a business. You know, we see the cost of capital for ourselves. And now that we've, you know, taken on additional funding, it's like, oh, we got to get this monkey off of our back, this additional, you know, and like for a small business, like it's a pretty hefty amount, you know, what we're paying each month. And so, you know, strategizing with our CFO about, okay, how do we get, you know, slice this down as quickly as possible, but also not drain our cash too fat. Like, it's just this sort of math problem. It's really interesting, but and strategy, you know, issue as well.
And maybe to add to that, this is an important point for us. We always ensure that whenever we lend, we don't put too much pressure on businesses. We understand that what we're doing is giving them a bridge to success. So it's sometimes survival, sometimes is just stabilize the business. Sometimes is, and the point is we want them to graduate away from us. That's one of our key elements. And I have a few success stories to share about that.
Yeah, please. Would love to hear. What's like your favorite one? Like what's the one that comes to mind when someone asks, okay, who's been your favorite client or, you know, however you frame it?
There are probably two. One is an emergency situation. So it's a family run spice producer that has been around for generations. And unfortunately for them, a supplier made mistakes and that led to nut contamination. And all of suddenly, no one wanted to touch them with a barge pole. They didn't want it to lend to them when they needed it the most. You know, they had to restock to find another supplier. Their stock was basically useless. And we stepped in. We gave them this breathing space to restock, and now they pulled through. So they had a big loan that really saved the company. And then another favorite example of mine is an established roofer. He was working for council on council projects, and the business itself was relatively okay, but the owner had terrible personal credit. So no one would back him. So we did first lend him £20,000, then several months later, £40,000, and then later £60,000. And that brought him to a place where his finances were stable. And once he was back on track, we offer him an invoice finance facility, which is he sell us basically his invoice, and that helped him with his liquidity. Now that he's strong enough, he graduated away from us, which is exactly our mission. We helped him to survive, to stabilize and thrive now.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. And I think those must be so, you know, we always talk about brand purpose and what we do, and those must be so gratifying to, like, you know, look at someone, they put their blood, sweat and tears into their business, and, you know, sometimes for no fault of their own, it feels like it's going to go under just because of cash, you know, and not to play light of it, but like cash is cash, you know, and to come in and save, you know, or help someone save their business, I should say, like that must be so gratifying. So yeah, thank you for what
it
you
is,
do.
It is. And it comes with gratification on the one hand, but also its challenges, because obviously you have the other side of the coin. You have people who try to defraud us. People will try to take advantage of us. And that's where the discipline comes in. That's where data and open banking will help us tremendously, have helped to avoid a crisis.
I'm sure. That's really interesting. Would love to get into your personal journey that's kind of shaped your approach. Because I was struck in our previous conversations by kind of just the integrity and again, the purpose, you know, with which you would attack this work. You don't tend to hear kind of that touchy-feely language from a lot of lenders. And so it's really refreshing. So, you know, you've been quoted as saying, culture is the ultimate multiplier of success. No egos, no toxicity, just trust and disciplined execution. And that's so inspiring. It's so straightforward and clear. Talk to us about that philosophy and how it's shaped Funding Alternative.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I said that on another podcast and I really meant it. So we have what I call a no dickhead policy. So no matter how talented or how hardworking someone is, if they bring toxicity to the team, they are not a fit for us. So it sounds a bit blunt, but it's about protecting the trust within the team. And I know from experience that one bad attitude can poison the team. So culture is way too valuable to risk it. And for me, culture is not just a mantra or a slogan. It is something you have to live every day. So it starts with me first and the management team in particular. So I have a very high expectation of my people, but I also recognize that they are humans. So they can make mistakes and mistakes happen. So I have to set the bar as high as I can by holding myself to the same high standard and showing the quality of the work I expect. So it's doing it yourself, your role model. And when mistakes do happen, the focus is definitely forward-looking, not backward-looking. And I'm usually the first to acknowledge my own mistakes in front of the team. And I encourage people to speak up when something goes wrong.
No, that's great. And I think that's probably been, I think, one of my biggest lessons as a leader is that energy, you know, that flows from you as the leader and also the senior management team, and how that impacts the team sometimes in ways that you don't expect or don't realize, but just how that sort of shapes the weather in your organization. So yeah, thank you for that. So it's a good reminder. We'd love to dig into this amazing moniker you have, business physicist. So, you know, you've got a background in physics, investment banking, hedge funds. We'd love to understand how this incredible mosaic background has influenced, you know, your approach to kind of simplifying the complexity that we see in the SME, you know, finance space.
Yeah, sure. So the training in physics gave me just a way to look at things and at the world through more of a system thinking. So you learn to break down very complex problems into simple and part and its fundamental part. That builds critical thinking. So I always go back to rationality. So decisions have to be grounded in rationality and not emotionality. It's very easy to fall into this trap of getting your emotion or leaving your emotion to drive your decisions. So I carry this mindset of rationality through my journey. And as you know, businesses is full of moving pieces, you know, capital, people, technology, markets. So you need to keep a level head and always know what matters. So this concept of signal and noise. So what is signal? What is noise? It's so easy to get bogged down into details. And yes, and you should know the details, but you also have to see the forest from the trees, while at the same time, obviously understand which tree makes up the forest. So it's about simplifying without losing touch with reality.
Oh, that makes sense. I love that, you know, focus on rationality. Like, I think you forget how easy it is because you're dealing with numbers and these structures that feel very sort of professional. And, you know, we're such emotional beings, we're such social beings. And I think as a leader, one thing I've learned is, I had one coach who said, don't let your monkey out. You know, like how much we can just switch that on and fool ourselves into thinking that we're actually acting rationally when we are actually being emotional, balancing those two incredible forces. So I really appreciate that that take that you have there.
And if I may add, I mean, you're absolutely right. But rationality alone doesn't build great companies.
Of course. Yeah. And of course.
You have to lead with the emotionality. So otherwise, people wouldn't trust you.
Yeah.
And when we talk about culture, it's about trust very often.
Yeah. 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 I feel like the culture word, the C word, gets thrown around a lot.
Yes.
And we'd love if you have any advice for folks who are, you know, maybe they're looking to start a new company and build a culture, or maybe they have started a company and they want to go on a journey of repair and kind of improving the culture. Any tips on culture building?
Yeah, maybe. Or more generally, if you take a step back, and I wrote an article about that. I think you start becoming an entrepreneur even before you even hand in your notice. I think preparation is everything. And there is a lot you can do and should do while you're still in a corporate role, for instance, to give yourself really the best chance to succeed. And there are a few of them. So one is, first is building core skills. So you need to be comfortable with the fundamental. And you mentioned finance in your case. And when you are on a job, you can start familiarizing yourself with finance, accounting, and even sales. That's important. Another aspect is negotiation skills. You will use them everywhere. So it's important to be prepared and sharpen them. And a third one I see a lot is people don't necessarily have developed a huge understanding for the commercial instinct they should have. You need to understand how money is made, what is a cost structure, how to manage a P&L if you can. It would be great on a job, but you can learn that. And one important aspect, which I've experienced myself, is I've ignored office politics when I was on a job. But actually, it is essential, I think, to understand this dynamic when you have to manage people and make tough decisions. So when you're on a job, practice office politics, because the better you are at this, the better you will be at understanding the dynamic within your team. So these are all aspects of preparing for entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice, Serge. Like, you know, this idea that you start becoming an entrepreneur before you step into the role. I shudder to think at how, you know, unfortunately I didn't receive an education. All these core skills like finance and sales and negotiation and that commercial instinct have really had to, by hook or by crook, build it. And it's been tough. You know, you learn by doing and you make a lot of mistakes, and those mistakes cost money. They cost people, not death, but like sort of, you know, you lose staff and things like that. And yeah, the office politics piece as well. I was having dinner with a friend of mine who's he's also kind of on the road. He's, you know, works in mathematics and building models about airflow and fluidity and stuff like that. I actually thought about you. But he said the same thing. He's like, I've learned to love office politics. And he's now understanding how to get good at it, how to do it well, and how that will help his career progression. So that was really cool to hear from someone who's so sort of, you know, analytical and in the numbers and things like that. So I agree with you there.
Very important indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's jump in as we round things out here to the quickfire round. So I'm going to ask you a couple, about five quickfire questions. Keep your answers really, really short. Just the first thing that comes to mind and a quick sentence about why. It's just kind of like a fun way for the audience to get to know you a little bit better. So first one, if you could found another startup, maybe in tech, maybe otherwise, what would it be and why?
Yeah, it would definitely be a medtech. And focus on the ecosystem between bacteria and human. Because actually, one of the background is you carry more bacterial DNA in our gut than our own. So cracking that complexity is a huge challenge and will impact human health tremendously.
That's really cool. Yeah, we hear a lot about the gut microbiome. So that's an amazing answer. It's one of the better ones we've had. Thank you for that. What tech invention makes you the most excited and why?
Oh, for me, it's undoubtedly the resurgence of robotics, because that's where AI meets the real world. The machine don't just process information, but they really interact through robots with us physically. And that interaction has a potential to transform everything from healthcare, manufacturing, and more.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I love that definition of robotics too, like where AI meets the real world and humans. That's fantastic. Flip side of that question, what tech right now makes you the most concerned and why?
Yeah, ironically, it's exactly the same that excites me, robotics. Because imagine once you replace humans in the physical world, you control the world. Imagine as simple as soldiers as robots. No fear of destruction, no questioning of authority. And that's where the ethical risks become enormous.
Well, thank you, Serge. I just want to say this has been an amazing conversation. I think it shows how Serge and your team at Funding Alternative, you're tackling one of the most challenging issues in the UK economy and globally, which is helping SMEs access the capital they need to thrive. It's something we felt personally as a business here at Literal Humans, and we benefited from folks like yourself who have lent their hard-earned money to help us succeed as a business. I think in particular, your mix of scientific thinking and practical business execution is a really fantastic example of, you know, innovation that makes a real world impact. Cool. The fourth question here is just who's a literal human who's been integral to your career journey? You want to shout out?
Yes, yes. Obviously, a few people like many of us have shaped my journey. But in the context of Funding Alternative, I would definitely highlight my co-founder, Warren. And we've built this as a strong team from day one. So a big shout out to him.
Amazing. Yeah, amazing. And relatedly, what's an inspirational quote that's stuck with you through your journey in tech?
Yeah, I think today it's a quote from Roy Hamara, who said, "We tend to overestimate the effect of technology in the short run, but underestimate the effect in the long run." And this is a great reminder to stay grounded in the hype cycles, but also think about its impact in the long run and long term.
That's a great quote for like this moment, you know, when everything feels like it's swirling with AI. So yeah, that's really good. Well, listen, Serge, I really love this conversation. I mean, I think it shows how you're tackling one of the most challenging issues in our economy, which is helping SMEs get access to capital they need to thrive. It's something we've felt personally as a business. And so have a lot of respect and am humbled by the work that you're doing. I think in particular, your mix of scientific thinking with like practical, really practical business execution is a fantastic example of, you know, innovation that is making a real world impact. There's lots of innovation that isn't, you know. So I just want to thank you again for joining us. And if you could let our listeners know where they can find out more about you and your work at Funding Alternative.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's a great podcast. Really love it.
Cool. And we'll include all the links to, you know, Funding Alternative. And I think you mentioned some research that you've done or something like that before.
So I have a series of articles. So you can find them on my LinkedIn profile. But I'm coming up with a website also summarizing all what I've done. So from articles to a few short videos. So I'm working on this as well.
Cool.
To share a bit my two cents on how entrepreneurship could work or didn't work. I think failure is quite an important part of the
Absolutely.
Journey, as you know, Paul.
And I'm sure you've learned a lot too. So we'd love, please send that over. We'll include it in the episode description. And I think it'll be a great, you know, learning journey for our audience to learn from those failures. And you've seen so many businesses come through. So let's definitely share those. And for our audience, please, as always, leave a review and give us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed the episode. It helps us bring on great guests like Dr. Serge Santos, the founder and CEO of Funding Alternative Group. So Dr. Santos, thank you so much. Mike.